The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I want to recount one of these ancient suttas, discourses of the Buddha, that has a little bit to do with spiritual friendship. And maybe it was partly inspired by the idea we're having a picnic and some of us will come together in friendship with each other and get to know each other a little more. And this particular text ends with a poem. So I'll start with a poem. Okay? So it has a little more impact at the beginning. And the poem uses the word heart for some of what it's going to say. And the word, that's the ancient word, could easily be translated into mind. And so you can, if you want, you can translate it to mind for yourself if it's more meaningful for you. Or if not, you can just keep this in your heart. Little thoughts, subtle thoughts, when followed, stir up the heart. Not understanding the thoughts of the heart, one runs here and there, the mind out of control. But understanding the thoughts of the heart, one who is ardent, mindful, restrains them. When followed, they stir up the heart. One who is awakened lets them go without a trace. So a way of being with thoughts, either having them stir you up and agitate the mind, or just let them pass through and let go of them. And the idea that they let them go and they don't leave a trace. They don't agitate at all, and there's no remnant, and it's not sticky in any way, and doesn't create a chain reaction of one thought leading to the next, to the next, to the next, and sometimes in exciting ways for the mind. So this is the concluding poem, or summing up this text, this story. And so it's a story about a monk who is having trouble with his thoughts in meditation. I think the language is he's assailed by thoughts of sensual pleasure of all kinds, thoughts of ill will, resentment, and thoughts of hostility, and so he's just troubled by these things, and he is surprised by this, and the way I just love the way that he reflects on his surprise. He says, well, in this translation it goes, how amazing. I love it. How amazing. My mind is out of control. I mean, it has such a nice feeling as opposed to, oh, shit. not again. You know, I'm a meditation failure. I hope no one notices. And you know, just like rather than being discouraged, he said, "How amazing!" And then he goes to the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, "How amazing!" Rather than being embarrassed, he says, "How amazing!" He goes to the Buddha to get some support, I suppose, and help. So, you know, it's not like he's amazed and just going to let it keep going. But he says, how amazing, Buddha, let me tell you. But this is the story. So the monk's name is Meghiya. And I think he's a relatively new monk, young monk. In the morning, it was time for Meghiya. Meghiya was the only one with the Buddha at that time. And the story kind of comes alive a little more if you think of the Buddha as an old man by now. You know, he died when he was 80. And the two of them are dwelling alone someplace in the woods. And Meghiya asks permission to go off in the morning for alms. Because the only way the monastics will have food every day is that they go to town with their bowl, and people offer food in their bowl, and they go home, go back to the forest, and they eat it. And so Meghiya asks to go off to alms. And my assumption is that the Buddha doesn't go to alms because Meghiya is kind of the Buddha's attendant, and he's probably planning to get enough for both of them. Buddha maybe is an old man, he's not going to go so much, and so Meghiya is helping out. So Meghiya goes to town, gets alms. Now on the way back, he sees on the side of the river a delightful mango grove. The mango groves are big, kind of luscious leaves, wonderful canopy, they create wonderful shade, they create kind of coolness underneath them because of the transpiration. And by the river, just delightful location. And Meghiya says, wow, this is a great place to meditate. What if I come and spend the rest of the day here meditating? So he goes to the Buddha, and I guess they have their meal. And then Meghiya says to the Buddha, I found this great spot to meditate. May I go there and spend the day meditating? And the Buddha says, please wait until another monk comes to be with me. So clearly the Buddha has a need for an attendant, but we don't know why. Maybe, I guess I said, maybe he's old. So he says, please wait until another monk comes to be with me. And Meghiya says this. You, Buddha, have nothing further to do and nothing further to add to what has been done. Meaning, you're already fully enlightened. So you don't have to go off and practice anymore, you know, you're in this way. So, you have nothing further to do. I, however, have something further to do and something further to add to what I have done. If the Buddha gives me permission, I would like to go to the mango grove to exert myself in meditation. So the first time he just asked, you know, so he just asked, could I go? And the Buddha says no. And second time he explains more. And the Buddha, for the second time, the Buddha says, as long as I'm still alone, stay here until another monk comes. But then a third time, Meghiya said to the Buddha, you have nothing further to do and nothing further to add to what has been done. I, however, have something further to do and something further to add to what I've done. If the Buddha gives me permission, I would like to go to the mango grove to exert myself in meditation. Now, it seems in this ancient times, when you ask someone three times, that's something, that's a big deal. And so you got to, you know, you kind of... So the Buddha says, as you are talking about exertion, as you're talking about applying yourself in meditation, what can I say? I want to go off and practice. Well, what should, you know, of course, what can I, how can I stop you? Do what you think is now time to do. So he said, well, if you really think this is what's important for you, and you've heard me, you know, twice say, you know, please stay, you must have something clearly in mind, you must know something or something, so who am I to stop you? Please go. So then Meghiya went to that mango grove. On arrival, having gone deep into the grove, he sat down at the foot of a certain tree for his day's meditation. Nice, huh? We'll all go to the park up the street and sit at the foot of a tree and spend the day meditating or talking to each other. Now, while Meghiya was staying in the mango grove, he was for the most part assailed by three kinds of unskillful thoughts: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. The thought occurred to him, how amazing, how awesome. Even though it was through faith that I went forth from home to the homeless life, still I am overpowered by these three kinds of unskillful thoughts. So his amazement, I think, is something that many meditators can be amazed at. People can have tremendous dedication to want to practice, that this is the time to do it. They sit down. Some people go on retreat. They, you know, spend maybe months and months and months planning to go on retreat, arranging to go on retreat, inspired to go on retreat, determined to really apply themselves when they get to the retreat. And they finally get to the retreat, and they're really finally here to practice, and their mind gets pulled into thoughts about anything but the retreat. You know, like it's almost like the retreat doesn't exist for them, because the mind spins off and thinking about plans and memories and resentments and desires of all kinds. And so like, wow. So no one's ever come to me and said, "Gil, how amazing." I was so inspired to come on retreat, but my mind is spinning and agitated and all these different things. How amazing. So he explains this to the Buddha. He's amazed. And then in the late afternoon, he left his place of meditation and went back to the Buddha. And he explained to the Buddha, how amazing. Even though I went forth and went to practice with lots of faith and lots of inspiration, I was still assailed by all these thoughts. And then the Buddha's response, I think, kind of compassionate. He doesn't say, you know, "I told you not to go." But what he does do is he explains how having good spiritual friends is beneficial for this process of practice. So for that day, he's Meghiya's good spiritual friend. He's the companion. He's the Sangha member. And so he's kind of saying indirectly, well, you had this opportunity here. And for people who are still not mature in their practice, it's really good to have five things. And the first one is this good spiritual friends, but then he'll come back and he'll go into more detail about this. So if one's practice is still immature, five qualities bring it to maturity. Having admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades. Having good friends as friends, companions, and comrades. This is the first quality that brings the mind to maturity. Furthermore, a monk is virtuous. A monastic is virtuous. The monastic dwells restrained according to the monastic rules and is careful in his or her behavior and sphere of activity. He or she trains themselves, having undertaken the training rules, seeing danger in the slightest faults. This is the second quality that brings one to maturity. Furthermore, they get to hear at will, easily and without difficulty, talk that is truly inspiring and conducive to the opening of awareness. So this is great. So to be able to hear talks, Dharma talks. And it's interesting that the topics he's going to give, these are the important topics. So I should take note of this. And they're done kind of in sequence, and they kind of build on each other. Like one's more kind of the foundation for the next, then the foundation for the next, and so forth. So one of the good qualities of support is to be able to hear talks, Dharma talks, that are inspiring and conducive to the opening of awareness. Talk on modesty, contentment, seclusion, which means going on retreat, non-entanglement, arousing effort, virtue, concentration, wisdom, release, and the knowledge and vision of release. So because it's a nice little quality, modesty. Not sure, you know, if this is the best translation, but it has a nice, you know, has can have a nice feeling to it, to not be too arrogant or too conceited in our approach to practice. And perhaps one of the problems Migya had is that maybe his enthusiasm to practice, that's a good place to practice, I'm going to do it, by golly, this is my chance, you know, I'm capable and I can, you know, go do it. You probably know that, I probably said it enough times, but there's a story of a young, capable, smart, aristocratic man who's used to accomplishing things and getting what he wants, and he decides to go off to the monastery to get enlightened. And so he shows up, and the abbot welcomes him. But before he really wants to get started, the young man says to the abbot, "Well, if I practice here, practice hard, how long will it take before I get enlightened?" The abbot says, ten years. Well, that's like a bit long for this man who's used to getting what he wants. And so he says, "Well, you know, I'm capable and smart and can make good effort, and if I really apply myself and stay up late and, you know, really try and really engage, you know, 110%, you know, how long will it take?" And the abbot says, "Oh, well, in that case, it'll take 20 years. So the idea of modesty, or not being so conceited, or kind of a certain kind of humility or humbleness, maybe that's a healthy form of humbleness or humility, maybe. And the contentment, to be discontented, there's a time and place to be discontented. It's very helpful for Buddhists to be discontented about their suffering. If you're contented with your suffering, then you just keep suffering. But to be agitated by discontented by your number of possessions you have, or the number of smartphones you have, you don't have enough or something, or the number of discontented with the worldly affairs, and that's what keeps you agitated. That's not really so conducive for what this translation calls the opening of awareness, or the settling of awareness, or doing this practice. So to have some contentment with one's life. In the monastic world, monastics are supposed to be content with just the clothes they have on. They're supposed to be content with having just enough clothes to keep themselves warm and a little bit protected from the insects. But, you know, just... And so most monastics will have maybe one or two sets of robes. And not more. Content with the food that you're given. It's whatever's given that day, be content with that. Be content with the housing that you're given. So if you're given a housing, if you're given some place to sleep, just be content with whatever it is. And then content with the medicines that you have, take care of your health. And those are the four requisites, the four primary things monastics are supposed to need. And from our point of view, modern, Western, especially fairly affluent lifestyles, the monastic lifestyle would be seen to be ascetic. But the Buddha clearly designed the monastic life to not be ascetic, but to be just enough to be comfortable in that time and place. But not any more, not a lot of extra stuff to take care of and pursuits and things like that. So contentment, and then seclusion. Seclusion generally in this tradition here, what it means is don't go be a hermit exactly, but spend time maybe alone, being on retreat. Spend time on retreat, secluded from worldly affairs, worldly events. And so in our tradition here, we will go on retreats often. And it's secluded from the outside world and usual affairs we have to be involved in. And that allows for a deepening of the practice, having that kind of withdrawal from ordinary life for a while. And then non-entanglement. I love non-entanglement. Some of you are probably more entangled in things than you wish. And then arousing effort, virtue, concentration, discernment. So this is a third quality that brings one to maturity. Further, monastics keep their persistence aroused for abandoning unskillful mental states and for taking on skillful mental states. They are steadfast, solid in their effort, not shirking their duties with regard to cultivating skillful qualities. Well, things like modesty, contentment, non-entanglement, effort, virtue, these are all kind of mental states. And so to develop, to kind of avoid the opposite of those and develop those states. And there's a lot of other states, but to have some ability to track your own mind, to be attentive to the quality of your heart, quality of your mind, and be able to have to guide it, to direct it, to use maybe the rudder in the mind to move you towards the skillful states, the beneficial states of mind, the healthy states of mind, and use the rudder of the mind to steer you away from the unhealthy ones. And there might be activities, might be ways of thinking, there might be particular ways that you are that tend to bring you into frustration, stress, resentment, anger, greed, lust, and all kinds of things that keep you agitated. And if you want to be settled in your mind, that's not the place to go. And there are other ways, other states of mind, other ways of thinking, other activities that you do, ways of being, that help settle the mind, that clarify the mind, that brings clarity and non-agitation. So the idea is to have a clear sense of the direction the mind can take, or how, the different quality of mind that we can have, and be the custodian of that, be the caretaker of this, not just be the recipient of whatever state of mind that you're given each day, you know, as if, you know, you're a passive passenger in your own car all the time. You know, you don't have to be a passenger in your own mind. It is your mind, after all. So, you know, you can be a little bit in the passenger seat, or if you don't want to feel like you're too much in control, you can just think of the mind not as a car, but as a boat, and just, you know, be careful what direction the rudder is aiming. And then the fifth one furthermore, the monastics are wise, endowed with a wisdom of impermanence, of arising and passing. So to have a deep, wise discernment, wise sensitivity, wise perspective on the impermanent nature of our life, how things change, and all kinds of levels, I think is useful. There's a level of just birth and death. You know, how long are you going to live? You know, if you knew you were going to die next month, tomorrow, today, how would you live? What would you do with your precious life? But if you're going to live forever, you can just kind of coast along and go shopping for more TVs or something. And then the impermanence of the changing, you know, circumstances of the day, from the time you wake up to you go to sleep, all the different changes that come through, and to kind of surf and be sensitive to the changes and the coming and going of things, and rather than being caught up in the middle of the drama of the moment, just see it all as coming and going. And then to be sensitive to the moment-to-moment changeableness of the mind, of perception, of this world that we're in. It's a kind of psychedelic world we live in. If we kind of can stop being so caught up in our thoughts and tune into the constant flow and change of this river of life that goes on here all the time. And this is one of the directions that Buddhist Dharma is pointing towards, is the real sensitivity, be a wise sensitivity to impermanence and change. So these are the five qualities that support the maturity of the mind, maturation of a practitioner. The Buddha teaches maggiya. But then he goes and makes this. This is a, kind of the main point for today. I thought they were one of the things about having good. This translation calls admirable people as friends. Some people, it's kalyanamitta. Sometimes people call it good spiritual friends. When a monastic has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, it is to be expected that they will be virtuous. Okay, that's nice. So if you have a lot of good, if you really admire your friends, respect them, they're kind of spiritual friends, they're inspiring in their practice themselves. Generally, that you're not going to go around and tell, you know, and be stealing and killing and lying around them, I mean, they would kind of look at you and say, what? You know, what are you doing? You know, or they kind of wince. You know, if you're spending a lot of time lying and, you know, you bring out the whiskey and you start, you know, downing it and start swaying as you walk. You know, your friends are not, your good spiritual friends are kind of like, you know, really? You know, you don't really want to, you know, they support you, they tend to support people to have the best in people to come, what's best in people tend to come out. And so spend time with the people that brings out the best in you. Don't spend time with people that bring out the worst in you. And then the Buddha says, when monastics have admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, it is expected that they will get to hear at will, easily, and without difficulty, talk that is truly inspiring and conducive to the opening of awareness. That is, talk on modesty, contentment, seclusion, non-entanglement, arousing persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, release, and the knowledge and vision of release. So, you know, if you have good spiritual friends, people in the Dharma who are your buddies and spend time with, chances are fairly, you know, good that from time to time you'll have Dharma talks. You'll share a little bit about your practice, what inspires you, your questions, and you'll be able to talk about some of these topics, you know. And some of you might go home to, or spend time at the picnic maybe or somewhere and say, you know, Gil talked about modesty. I've never thought about it before. And then you could have a conversation about modesty. And wow, you know, you could instead have a conversation about the World Cup. You know, that's also exciting these days. But, you know, which is most conducive to you for, you know, settling the mind, opening awareness. When monastics have admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, it is to be expected they will keep their persistence aroused for the abandoning of unskillful qualities, mental states, and for the taking on of skillful mental states. So here also, you know, when you're around people, there are people who will bring out the best in you. And so you'll tend to kind of veer away from these unhealthy states of mind. You don't have complete control over it, but, you know, we tend not to support them, feed them as much when we're around people who inspire us and who are kind of examples of the opposite. And we're more likely to call on those qualities for us and to live that way and be that way. I think it's one of the great benefits that I had from spending about 10 years of my life in monastic settings, Buddhist monastic settings. And so 24 hours a day I was around other practitioners and admirable friends. And even the people who were not so inspiring to be with, they were there practicing. They were doing their best. They were trying. And just to be around people who were doing their best, trying to find a way with their minds and themselves, inspired me and supported me in my efforts to do so. And then... And when a monastic has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, it is to be expected that they will be wise, endowed with wisdom of arising and passing away, the wisdom of impermanence. So there's something about having, you know, good spiritual friends, at least in the Dharma, they're tuned in to impermanence and change. It's like, you know, this is one of the fundamental kind of perspectives that of kind of recognizing, oh, you know, it could be as simple as recognize, oh, you know, see, you're having a hard time, but maybe you're just having one of those kinds of days. I guess it's a drag, but it's only one of those kinds of days. You know, some of you, you know, Jack Kornfield likes to ask the question. I don't know if it works, how well it works for everyone, but well, he asks, you know, can you think of the worst day of your life? Hopefully, it's not today. The worst day of your life, and then where is it today? And somehow that things change and they come and go, and so we learn to hold things lightly and not be weighed down by what happens. Partly because we know things will change and are moving all the time. So good spiritual friends. So Magiya had one of the best spiritual friends he could have had, the Buddha, right there. And it would have been easy to have hung out with the Buddha and received some of the benefits that the Buddha talks about here of having good friends. And perhaps he wasn't ready to go off and do, you know, intensive practice alone. He needed to mature in these other ways that we come from being in community with each other. And so one of the wonderful opportunities about here at IMC is the opportunity of being practicing together with others in community. And it's a pretty special opportunity. There are other places we could go for this. Bay Area is kind of a mecca for Buddhism, so you know, you can look around and see if find a place that you like. But there are lots of people around the world. We get a lot of reports from people who listen to these talks in Audio Dharma who don't have community. They're off, you know, someplace where they're kind of the only person meditating, the only Buddhist, and they kind of are pretty, I don't know, I don't want to say envious, but, you know, pretty appreciative that they're here. You know, there's so many people who practice and people who practice for a long time. So to take the opportunity to get to know other practitioners, be buddies with them, and be able to have conversations, sometimes having tea with people, is a wonderful way to support practice and to grow in it. And we probably don't here at IMC do enough to support the building of community, the building of connections between people. It's easy enough to come Sunday morning and sit in, you know, in the outer hall someplace and back row and come and go and not have a conversation with anyone. And it's a little unfortunate that we don't have more ways of breaking the ice. But we do it occasionally, and we do it today. So for those of you who can come to the picnic, this is your chance to be with spiritual friends for a little while. And so you're all welcome to come, and you're all welcome not to come. It's all good. So thank you all. And so why don't you say hello and to maybe one or two people.